RN, your world unfolding.
Welcome back to the second hour of Friday Drive on RN. Julian Morrow with you. And coming up this hour, order, order, the RN News Quiz is back. It's the only question time guaranteed to be more entertaining than Parliament's. Plus, Unwatchable TV, the TV segment that reviews shows that are not legally available yet and gives you the chance to find out which fictional serial killer Kara Kidman is swooning to this week. And back out like Beckham, Greg O'Mahony will talk sport and the retirement of David Beckham. But first, let's have some more of our opening track. Of course, it's the Fine Young Cannibals, and She Drives Me Crazy.
RN. RN.
Certainly can't help himself. Yes, that's the RN remix of Fine Young Cannibals' She Drives Me Crazy. I'm sure that's bolting up the RN Drive charts as we speak. Of course, all our music selections from Simon Aveling. And, of course, in the second hour, every second week, it is time to deconstruct the week's events via the medium of a quiz. In the age of 24-hour news and the five-second soundbite, the news is often accused of being trivial. So on Friday Drive, we've completed the process and turned it into a quiz. Thankfully, joining us this evening to quiz our way through the week's events are Chris Berg from the Institute of Public Affairs, joining us from Melbourne. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. And in the Sydney studios, Rebecca Huntley from Ipsos Australia. G'day, Rebecca.
Good evening.
Fantastic to have you. And Nick Bryant, BBC correspondent for Australia, soon to be BBC correspondent for Washington. Commiserations on the demotion, Nick.
I had to start with a correction. It's actually New York.
Oh, New York. Oh, there you go. Anyway, all right, so, fair enough, too.
Take your part of the big apple.
All right, well, look, it is time to call this house to order.
Order!
Round one.
Order!
At least something's back in the black. Of course, it was the week of the budget this week, and it's one of the highlights of the political year. The second reading of the Appropriation Bill Number 1, a night where families all around the country get together, crowd around the television to see the Federal Treasurer deliver his budget because they didn't realise that was what was on telly at the time. Chris Berg, this week, of course, was Wayne Swan's sixth budget speech. I know that you've practically memorised all of them. I'm going to play you now three grabs from Wayne Swan budget speeches over the years. So many rhetorical highlights to pick from. We've had to narrow it down to three. Your job is to match the Wayne Swan budget quote to the year. And I think I'll give you the years up front just so you can try and nut this one out. You've got 2010, 2011 and 2012. They're the years to pick from in no particular order. Let's have a listen to the first Wayne Swan.
The 4 years of surpluses I announced tonight are a powerful endorsement of the strength of our economy, resilience of our people, and the success of our policies.
So 4 years.
Our strategy will see us return to surplus in 3 years, 3 years ahead of schedule.
And here's the third one.
Despite the total cost to the Commonwealth Government of over $8 billion, our commitment to tightening our belt has not diminished one bit. We will be back in the black by 2012-13, on time, as promised, Mr. Speaker.
Less laughs, I noted, this year in the budget speech, but there you have it. Chris, you've got back in the black by 2012-13. That was the first one. Strategy to return to surplus within 3 years, 3 years ahead of schedule, the second one, and then 4 years of surpluses as a powerful endorsement of the strength of the economy and the success of Labor policies. One was 2010, one was 2011, one was 2012, and none of them actually delivered a real surplus. Do you want to lock them in, Chris?
I reckon you played them in reverse chronological order.
Reverse chronological order.
The first one you played where he mentioned that we're announcing 4 years of surpluses, that was 2012.
And you are absolutely correct. That is right.
The second one you played, I think, was 2011, and the last one you played was 2010.
And you started so well, but then the other two went round the other way. Yeah, so strategy to see us return to surplus within 3 years, 3 years ahead of schedule, was actually 2010, and then, of course, the Back in the Black speech was 2012. Okay, Rebecca Huntley, this one's for you. When it comes to political rhetoric, budget speeches, perhaps as we've just heard, aren't always that most inspiring of fodder. The best lines do often come at the press conference afterwards.
Yes, it's true.
So your question, which Treasurer is this speaking? Which I reckon you'll get, so we're also going to throw in, and in what year?
Well, this is the one that brings home the bacon. This is the budget that pulls the whole game together.
Oh, yeah, that was his press conference. That was Keating's press conference.
Yes. So, Paul Keating, absolutely correct. Then Treasurer, PM soon to be, I suppose. And you can pick a year from the Hawke Keating years.
I'm thinking 1992 or 1992?
A little bit earlier, actually.
That was 1989.
A little bit earlier than that still. but we're heading in the right direction. It was 1988.
Ah, right. Yes. I was wondering whether it was before or after the recession.
Yes, yeah, well,
but
yeah.
Before he became Prime Minister.
Indeed.
But I don't know if he did. Yeah, I think there was. Anyway, sorry, I'm just kind of thinking of my Keating history. But yeah, I really screwed it up.
Basically. No, that's all right. That's all good. It's all good. Interesting. Only six treasurers. I mean, it's kind of regarded as, you know, an important post and for some people a stepping stone, but only six treasurers have gone on to serve as Prime Minister, and of course Paul Keating was one of them. Let's move on though now, Nick Bryant. Of course, one of the first things they give you when you get off the plane to be the BBC correspondent for Australia is a full list of Australian treasurers since Federation. I know you know them all, and I won't insult you by asking you to recite them. I'm going to give you an option here. Can you name either Australia's longest serving or Australia's shortest serving treasurer?
Well, the other thing they do when you get off the plane as a BBC correspondent is tell you never to go to Canberra for the lock-up. And I've managed to, 6 years, I've managed to avoid it.
Really? Thank, that's well done.
Thank goodness. The longest-serving treasurer. Well, does that get us into the territory of the treasurers that have never become Prime Minister? Are we talking Peter Costello?
You're pretty warm there. Yes, absolutely right. Peter Costello held the portfolio for a record term of 11 years and 8 months. A record I don't think he's particularly happy with, I've got to say.
No, quite.
All up.
And the shortest?
Shortest serving. Any takers on shortest serving?
John Kerrin, maybe.
John Kerrin, interesting suggestion. Chris Berg,
It's Bob Hawke.
You are absolutely correct. Well done.
He was treasurer for a day.
He was treasurer for one single day.
When was this?
So this was after Paul Keating resigned as treasurer back in 1991, and Bob Hawke had to decide on what now doesn't seem like that hard a decision between who, whether Ralph Willis or John Kerrin should be treasurer. He wasn't quite sure which one to lock in, so he became treasurer for a single day and then made the wrong decision.
And was the second shortest John Kerrin, or was there some other person in kind of, you know, 1954 or
well,
something?
Well, hold that thought, Rebecca Huntley,
okay. Oh,
because there's more arcana to dig up on the RN
but see,
drive.
I think the thing is, Hawkey...
Don't ruin the questions, Ellie.
I've got to say, I think Hawkey thought, I can do both of these jobs.
I'm sure he did.
And then he realised perhaps I shouldn't because...
A lot of Prime Ministers
it'll cut into my
though.
Chick time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Really, for my Prime Minister and Treasurer, there's a lot of reading material. I can't pick up chicks as much as I would normally do.
So. I think Chris Berg might be onto this there, because can you tell us the second shortest serving, Chris?
No, I can't.
Well, because it's the Prime Minister thing. Gough Whitlam was Treasurer for 14 days at the beginning of the Whitlam government as part of the Duumvirate Cabinet. There were only two ministers made up the entire Cabinet. And so Gough Whitlam was the Treasurer for those 14 days as well. 1991, the year that that Bob Hawke was Treasurer, there were actually five different people who held the Treasury portfolio. I can sense the lack of interest in that.
You're reminding me how much I'm going to miss Australia.
Yeah, that's right. Well, to me, it was a very interesting factoid. Paul Keating, John Kerrin, Ralph Willis, John Dawkins, and Bob Hawke.
By Italian standards, that's extraordinarily stable.
That's right, indeed. This is Question Time with Julian Morrow on RN Drive.
Order! Round two.
Order!
Ah, yes, Baby Love on RN Drive. It's question time. Joining us to dissect the week's events through the form of a quiz are Nick Bryant from the BBC, Rebecca Huntley from Ipsos Australia, and Chris Berg, doyen of treasurers in the Australian political history from the Institute of Public Affairs. Now, of course, this week, young mums-to-be across the country, I suppose, are mourning the government's decision to dump the $5,000 baby bonus, which has been providing support to the retail economics industry for many, many years. Rebecca, now, electronics, sorry. Rebecca, this is one interesting me. A baby bonus has been introduced by two previous Australian prime ministers. I'm only going to ask you to name one because I think it's a little bit unfair, but it's just a little quirk that we picked up. Can you name one Australian prime minister who introduced a baby bonus, and can you then just go on and really impress us by naming the other one?
Oh, well, there's John Howard, but
2002, John Howard is correct. Well done.
And then I'm just wondering whether
it goes a long way back.
It might have been a long way back. So 1930s.
Earlier.
Not like a First World War thing. We need more cannon fodder.
It's pretty close. Chris Berg is... in fact, it is. It's 1914.
Prime
Minister Andrew Fisher...
Breathe, this is going to be a long war.
That's right, exactly. Prime Minister Andrew Fisher introduced a baby bonus. It was called the Maternity Allowances Act, but it was also colloquially known as...
And how much was it?
The baby bonus was £5.
Straight to the bank.
Indeed. Well, it seems that both baby bonuses in Australia have copped similar criticisms because, on a Friday before RN Drive, I was looking through the National Library's Trove database, the digitised newspaper database.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It is fantastic.
It is amazing.
And I found an article from the Barrier Miner, the Broken Hill newspaper in 1922, saying, quote, "Since the baby bonus or bangle bonus," whatever that means, "or whatever the appropriate name for this ill-considered and most reckless method of squandering the public money was first introduced in Australia in 1914, they say, as at 1922, the £5 note has been claimed by nearly a million Australians.
And did they link it to slatternly, you know, young women deciding to have children because they wanted to buy a large wireless?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was all about that. Yeah, the latest crystal set on the market.
I worry that baby bonus would have been a little bit creepy because they would have just introduced huge immigration restrictions, and they might have thought, well, you know, if we can't bring them in, we have to breed them ourselves.
Well, you know what? There's another interesting little point there, Chris Berg, because the baby bonus, when initially passed by Andrew Fisher, was available irrespective of marital status, so not too much insistence on traditional marriage, and it could also be received by husbands of women who died in childbirth, but it was only applicable to mothers of European descent.
Yeah.
So there you go.
There we go.
So, wonderful part of our history.
Indeed. Let's move on, shall we? Chris, this one's for you. The Howard government policy, the baby bonus, their baby bonus was born in 2002, and at conception, at least, it was called the First Child Tax Refund. So it was actually a tax refund I think it was $2,500 a year for up to 5 years. The bonus as we know it was revved up a little bit later and led to this exchange on ABC TV with the then Minister for Family and Community Services, Kay Patterson.
"I believe this is a fantastic policy for mothers. They're going to get $3,000
they've never had before." Minister, that still doesn't answer my question with respect. Would it have been better to have announced and introduced this policy at the same time?
"Well, if I thought that mothers would put their babies at risk, but I don't believe that mothers would put their babies or their health at risk. Mums-to-be put the health of their babies as a priority."
Tim Lester there doing the questioning on the 7:30 report way back in July, on the 1st of July indeed, 2004. Chris, why was Tim Lester pursuing that particular line of questioning about the introduction of the baby bonus?
There's a theory that people will be encouraged to have their children or to give birth to their children before or after the policy is introduced, so on July 1st of the next year.
So a big win for classical economics, even in the case of childbirth, rational actors.
That's the theory, and apparently the best evidence we have is that it bears out in the data.
Should say that, Chris Berg, because on the line, right, as we speak, we have Andrew Lee, member of the federal Parliament and noted economist. Andrew, you're the man who, with your partner Joshua Gans, economics partner that is, did the research into this one to analyse the effect of cash bonuses on the baby bonus. On the birth rate. Is that right?
That's right, Julian, and g'day to Nick, Rebecca and Chris.
Hi.
G'day, Andrew.
Now, why did you decide to, you know, take this beautiful moment of human, exuberance and turn it into an economic study, Andrew?
So it was about 2006, and I was visiting the University of Melbourne and got to know Joshua there. And Joshua said, you know, we really should look at whether the introduction effect to the baby bonus caused births to be shifted. And I said, that's nuts. There's no way anyone would shift their birth for $3,000. And he said, well, you know, the reason I'm concerned about this is our third child was born in July 2004, and there was an awful lot of congestion in the maternity ward, even by the middle of July 2004, so I reckon they did. And so it was the simplest study we've ever done. We went and got the data, we graphed it, and we had daily birth data for 30 years. The number one day was the 1st of July 2004, the day the baby bonus was introduced.
Indeed, and apparently, 1,167 births shifted from June to July that year, according to Joshua. And I believe the same thing happened when the baby bonus went up in 2006. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So Howard Government, we put out our study just before the scheduled increase to the baby bonus in 2006, and we were confident that social science would prevail and that the Howard Government would see their way to phasing in that increase. They didn't, and we then dutifully recorded that the same shifting had happened again. And the problem isn't when people shift a day. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks there's a medical risk there, but the maternity wards are pretty poorly set up for severe congestion. So we estimated there was some amount of shifting going on 2 or 3 weeks. And so at that stage, you tend to wonder about babies that were pushed very late term and the potential health risks that could engender.
Andrew, I've got to ask, as an economist, when this data comes back as you expected, is this a happy moment for you as a human being, or are you sort of slightly disappointed that people were holding out for the cash?
A little bit of both, I've got to be honest, Julian. There's the researcher bit of you that just things are beautiful when human beings behave exactly as our textbook models will. I think this even gets included in one of the first year textbooks as one of those standard examples that even in areas you wouldn't expect incentives to matter, they actually do. But yeah, it's a worry in a kind of deep moral sense that there was this shifting going on and that it was allowed, because of course you don't shift by crossing your legs. You shift by moving the timing of induction and cesarean section procedures.
So, I wanted to ask that question, Andrew. And I mean, could you go down and look at the data and see that the people were shifting were doing inductions? And because I want to say, having had a child naturally, you know, you kind of say, one day really doesn't make
There's a moment where the baby bonus is not really a big factor.
I'm telling you, one day makes an enormous difference. And, you know, and my experience too is that the basically you don't have a lot of clenching capacity at that stage, really.
You
know, really
you stop being a rational actor, we'll put it that way.
But I am interested, were you able to go down to the data and see, were these people having voluntary cesareans and inductions and so forth?
Absolutely. So right, we show in the paper, we plot births by different types of procedures, vaginal births, complete flat line, no shifting, but inductions and C-sections, which now
really
constitute half of all Australian births, show big drop before the introduction of the baby bonus, spike after the introduction.
The thing that's really interesting about this, though, is that, you know, because I got the baby bonus, is that a lot of my friends were saying, well, a lot of us weren't going to get maternity leave because there was no maternity leave. The baby bonus was our only real chance to get any kind of cash. And so I'd be interested to see, you know, whether they're kind of, you know, that's just not happening anymore now.
Well, there you go. I mean, further research required,
exactly.
Clearly. Andrew, and no doubt you'll be potentially running this as an argument in favour of the government's decision not to continue with the baby bonus. But thank you so much for joining us on RN Drive this evening.
Pleasure, Julian. Thanks very much.
Andrew Lee there, Member for Fraser, Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister, and he and his economic research partner, Joshua Gans, looking into the effect on birth rates of the baby bonus. This is Question Time, the RN News Quiz on RN Drive. Julian Morrow with you. It's time for the next round.
Order!
Round 3.
Order!
And I've been taking care of business every day.
Yes, a huge week for politics junkies this week. Not just the budget speech, of course, but also the budget reply. Something I quite like because it meant we got a week off the checkout on ABC TV, thanks to Tony Abbott, who got fairly good ratings, I might mention. Anyway, moving on. Of course, the budget reply speech is a big ticket item for the Leader of the Opposition of the day. And Tony Abbott was out there last night strutting his stuff. The Coalition prides itself on supporting the business community. And Tony Abbott, this one's for you, Chris Berg, even included a bit of product placement in his budget reply speech last night. He name-checked a few companies. I assume there were no commercial arrangements behind that, but we're interested if you can name which companies Tony Abbott cited in his budget reply speech.
I can name one.
Yes, yeah.
I didn't know that it was R.M. Williams.
Exactly, exactly.
Which is weird, because that was when I turned it on. And it's just like, and I'd like to thank R.M. Williams. Wow, politics has changed.
Yeah, that's right. It was kind of more like The Voice than the budget reply speech.
Look, I know donations are important, but come on.
Yeah, no, exactly. And not just product placement, of course, because he was wearing the boots as well. Look, I won't ask you to name the other three, but let's have a listen to Tony Abbott from the budget reply speech.
And with the right product, our manufacturing too is capable of competing with the best in the world, even with the high dollar, as demonstrated by Cochlear, Blackmores, Murray Goulburn and R.M. Williams, whose boots I'm wearing tonight.
A very carefully crafted political speech there. Cochlear, he's a man who listens. Blackmore, I don't know, he into vitamins or health or something. Murray Goulburn, milk, supporting Australian milk producers. And R.N. Williams, because he loves his boots. Okay, Nick Bryant, as you rightly named before, with the transparent assistance of Rebecca Huntley, Australia's longest-serving treasurer is Peter Costello, who delivered 12 budgets from 1996 to 2007. It's a pretty hard slog having to give the budget reply speech. Can you name... Oh, look... What, one or two people who had to give budget replies to Peter Costello?
Oh, very good question. Do you know, I did get Peter Costello on my own.
Did you? There was all sorts of writing happening in front of me.
I thought John Kerin was the shortest, but I forgot about the Prime Minister effect. I was helping him out.
Fair enough.
Not very well. I was feeding him the wrong
It's encouraged on question time.
And I'm still confused by Andrew Lee. And it reminds me of what I made the mistake of asking Andrew Lee whether he did Twitter or not. And he said to me, do you know what? I'm doing an experiment at the moment. One day I tweet, and at the end of it, I work out my productivity and my happiness levels. And the next day, I don't tweet, and I go
that's
through
right.
the same process.
He did a study.
And I said to him, my God, that sounds so convoluted and complicated. And he went to me, but it's the perfect random sample. Making me look as if I was an idiot.
Indeed.
And at that moment, I had two contradictory thoughts, one of which was, my goodness, he's the next Kevin Rudd. And the other one was, my goodness, he's the next Kevin Rudd. And he's a very smart guy, actually.
He is indeed.
Real
he
intellectual
is.
Blood bank. What yeah. was the question? Who gave the...
Well, budget reply.
So the budget to reply.
So, yeah, to Peter Costello. So he delivered 12 through 1996 through to 2007.
All right.
Tony Abbott gave, obviously, this year's one. That's a bit of a clue as to who you might be looking for. Can you name just a couple?
Well, Simon Cream would have been one of them.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the memorable one, obviously. Crean, one of the great orators of the modern era, a memorable speech. Any others?
Oh, let's think. Who would have been the shadow treasurer?
Well, you see, there's the trick, though, isn't it? Because it's the leader of the opposition.
Oh, sorry, the leader of the opposition.
Which is why you got Crean.
Yes. It would have been Mark Latham.
Mark Latham, correct.
It would have been, there's quite a few of them, aren't there? Kim Beazley.
Yes, correct. And one other?
Well, Kevin Rudd.
Absolutely. Four from four, Nick Bryant. There you go. I assumed that the BBC constantly takes stories on the budget reply speech, not crocs, not dangerous animals, but it's all about each one of those.
The problem with the budget reply, it coincided with the day that a kangaroo attacked a politician in Canberra, which obviously took it off the...
Really? Wow.
That one nudged that one off the airwaves.
As it should.
And the Skyworld, of course.
I'm letting my nerd run wild on this quiz tonight. So, Rebecca Huntley, this one's for you. Giving the budget reply speech as Leader of the Opposition, you know, arguably not an honour that you want to have too many times. There are a few people who've had to give a very, very large number of them, though. Can you speculate at all on who's given the most budget reply speeches in Australian history?
Oh, God, that's radio silence from some time, isn't it?
Now, remember, of course, we've established that it's the Leader of the Opposition,
mm-hmm.
And... if you look back over the years of the federal political scene, yes. Fair to say Labor's.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, I kind of thought Kim Beazley would be up there at least.
Kim Beazley is up there. He's
second or third.
He's second. He had 8 budget replies.
So I'm just trying to think about whether in that Menzies period they had the same. Well, that's the thing.
You're pretty close. Look, I won't prolong the agony any further. Kim Beazley did have 8. Bert Evatt had 8. Arthur Caldwell had 7. Gough Whitlam did 9 budget replies.
I would have picked Evatt or Caldwell or Whitlam.
Eight of them as opposition leader, but there have been a couple of instances where it isn't.
Were there
the
any
leader.
In Latin? Or did, sorry, oh,
regularly.
I did the 7th in Latin because I just couldn't. Be
just to show off, exactly, yeah. But it was, he did one when he wasn't the leader of the opposition. So even though it's a tradition in the Westminster system that it's normally the leader of the opposition, there have been 2 times when ministers other than the leader of the opposition have given the budget reply speech. This is question time at the RN Drive News Quiz. It is 29 minutes to 8. Julian Morrow with you.
Order!
Round 4.
Order!
Well, I'm truly into the classics with the music selections on the quiz this week. Of course, our guests are Nick Bryant from the BBC, Rebecca Huntley from Ipsos Australia, and Chris Berg from the Institute of Public Affairs. And that is Roy Orbison crying, of course. And that references another memorable moment of the week, which was the emotional speech from Prime Minister Julia Gillard introducing the disability care legislation. Let's have a listen to an excerpt from that speech.
The people who have gathered here today from around the country to witness this debate know what this means. There will be no more in principle and no more when circumstances permit.
That's right.
There will be launches, not trials. Permanent care, not temporary help. Yeah. Disability care starts in 7 weeks' time and there will be no turning back. I commend this bill to the House. Yeah.
A very emotional moment from the Prime Minister there. And this round's kind of devoted to those unusual and raw moments when politicians kind of drop the armour and we see something very different about them. Julia Gillard has had a few moments like that. Chris Berg, this first one's for you. We're going to hear some audio of another Julia Gillard address. Your question is, what event was the Prime Minister referring to and where was she when she said this?
I firmly believe you are the same people who amazed me when I was a small girl on that great day. I believed could do anything. I believe that still you can do anything. Thank you.
Yes, a slightly different tone to that particular wavering voice, but it was the Prime Minister in a fairly august forum. Any suggestions what that might be, Chris Berg?
Was that... I didn't recognise it, but was it the landing on the moon?
Yes, you are right. When I said august forum, I did assume that you were going to talk about the AWU National Conference, but no such luck. That was indeed Prime Minister Gillard referring to the landing on the moon, which is a little bit of a clue as to where she might have been saying it. Any thoughts there?
The moon.
didn't she address the UN? Or no, she addressed the American
session of Congress.
Yes, she did. She did address the Congress.
I didn't realise she's sworn though. The bleep.
Yeah, well, that was a hard thing.
Australians, you just can't stop
it. It was unparliamentary language, to be fair. But she did address
bloody,
the Congress.
Bloody Yanks.
That's right.
Bloody Yanks. You really know what you're.
The fourth Australian Prime Minister.
Good on the moon.
Exactly. To address Congress, and look, she really did leave a mark. I watched the speech, and it was a huge ovation. At the end of it. And it's fair to say that she won the crowd over because even though she got a standing ovation, as is the custom on arrival, I think she was starting from behind.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honour of presenting to you the Honourable Julia Gillard, Prime Minister of Australia.
A real testament to the strength of Australia-US relations there. That, of course, is known crier himself, House Speaker John Boehner.
And he cried that day.
Did he?
He was moved by what the Prime Minister said, yeah, and he blubbed himself.
But it doesn't take much to get Boehner into the waterworks, does it?
Maybe out of embarrassment.
Well, it was a strange moment, wasn't it? Because of all the things you'd expect a Prime Minister to get choked up about, reflecting on her youth and seeing the moon landing wouldn't have been up there. Were you surprised, Rebecca Huntley?
Oh, yeah. No, but I mean, who knows? She was probably jet-lagged. You know, when you're jet-lagged, you can watch an old episode of Bewitched and you start to cry. So I think that's really probably what happened.
Okay, all right. Well, Rebecca, this one's for you. Perhaps more understandable, this one. Which Australian politician is this speaking?
I want us to remember who we are. We're the ones that they knock down and we get up again.
An emotional... Not a federal figure.
Oh, I remember this.
But a rousing moment from a state leader. Any thoughts on who that might be? Nick Bryan, do you want to repay the favour?
No, yeah. Feed me a wrong answer. No idea.
It was Anna Bligh.
Do you want to have another listen? Oh, it was Anna Bligh. You're absolutely right.
It was Anna Bligh sounding more Prime Ministerial in a way than Julia Gillard. It was. Yep. Remember, Julia Gillard went up there and she was totally overshadowed by Anna Bligh. And I think many people... Mm. Our international viewers were looking in and thinking, wow, isn't Australia's first female Prime Minister great? And of course, they were looking at Anna Bligh, not Julia Gillard.
And of course, it did great things for the esteem that Anna Bligh was held in for that period. Yes. Although it didn't really translate at the ballot box, did it? I'm interested in this one, though, Rebecca. I mean, you're a social researcher. Yes. Do you have a sense of how the public reacts to politicians kind of letting it all hang out, those moments of raw emotion like that?
I think that they, in the case of Anna Bligh, it made people feel that, you know, she was really kind of communicating with them. They really liked the way she did it. It didn't necessarily, as you said, it evaporates.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like a speech at a wedding where, you know, that creepy uncle gets up. You don't particularly like him. He gives a nice speech. You know, you'll have a drink with him, but you still think he's a creepy uncle. So, I mean, I think that the liability is always as a woman, how you manage that as a female.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
So, I mean, Bob Hawke pretty much cried every Tuesday.
That's right. Well, we were going to make the whole round about Bob Hawke crying, but we would have been here for hours.
No, that's right. So, and I think he can kind of get away with it. In fact, I think that... you know, male politicians get away. It's quite risky, I mean, in some ways for Julia Gillard to let... But I think that was genuine. I think she probably remembered at that moment. She's also probably tired too. She cried Bewitched as well. She's really knackered. You know, it's a long way to September. But I think she probably remembered all of those people she's met who are really going, whose lives are going to be materially improved by the NDIS. And I think it's probably quite an emotional moment. But yeah.
Which leads us to our next grab. Nick Bryant, this one's for you. Another moment of raw emotion and tears from a politician. Who is this?
It's not easy. It's not easy. And I couldn't do it if I just didn't, you know, passionately believe it was the right thing to do. You know, I have so many opportunities from this country. I just don't want to see us fall backwards. You know, so.
A little bit of a golf clap there. This is a bit of a warm-up for your next gig, Nick Bryan, heading off to
indeed.
New York. Who was that?
Well, that was the day before the New Hampshire primary in 2008, and the voice, the teary voice, was Hillary Clinton.
Indeed.
She'd been written off. She'd lost the week before in Iowa. Everybody thought Obama was going to win New Hampshire as well. But she was asked that question in a diner by a woman voter. I think she asked her, how do you do it every day? How do you get up every morning? When you?
And there was a lot of speculation, I remember, about whether it was kind of affected or whether it was genuine.
It was was that an act of electoral calculation or were those teary secretions for real? And I think they probably were. And, of course, the upside was she went on the next day to win the New Hampshire primary.
Indeed. Julian Morrow with you, and this is Question Time on RN Drive.
Order!
Round 5.
Order!
One final bit of News Junkie trivia this week. Last week, of course, the government announced that there will be a referendum on Election Day this year. Voters will be asked to decide whether local councils and shires should be recognised in the Australian Constitution. Chris Berg, this one's for you. What was the last referendum that was held in Australia? What was it about and when was it?
Was it the 1999 Republic or...
It was indeed the 1999 vote on a republic.
That sounded a hell of a lot like a trick question.
No, it was fairly straightforward in the end.
And given I've got every question wrong, I have to say it was about the republic and also about the preamble. There
indeed,
was two aspects to it.
Indeed, and both went
and
down.
And both of them went down.
That's right. Okay, let's move on now to you then, Rebecca. This is a bit of kind of political advertising mm-hmm. history. We're going to play you now a jingle that was part of a referendum campaign. What was the campaign about? And, you know, just if you want to show off, what year was it?
Aborigines, they want to be Australians too. Vote yes and give them rights and freedoms just like me and you. Vote yes for Aborigines.
Fairly amazing, and now you think it's
vote
over.
Yes for Aborigines.
But it's not.
Aborigines, all parties say they think you should. Vote yes and show the world the true Australian brotherhood. Vote yes for Aborigines.
And still quite embarrassing, you think it's
vote
over.
Yes.
Make Aborigines Australians in every sense of the word. Write yes in the bottom square on your ballot paper.
Vote yes for Aborigines.
And it's not over yet.
Yes for Aborigines. All parties say they think you should. Vote yes and show the world the true Australian brotherhood. Vote yes for Aborigines. Vote yes.
It just
for
keeps
Aborigines.
Going.
They want to be Australians too. Vote yes and give them rights and freedom.
A moment of national unity not defined by inclusive language.
Did you fade
language,
that out, or
say.
Is it just?
No,
did
yeah,
you
it's, fade that yeah, out? It's actually a symphony that has four movements and lasts about 75 minutes.
I can just imagine these men in high-waisted pants. Somebody kind of, you know, got a wood block. But it's actually really awful that one of the proud. I mean, it's a proud and wonderful moment in our political history. With that kind of that inspired that kind of level of musical.
Indeed. We're short for time, so I'm going to ask the final question of you, Nick Bryant. This one's about your mother country. We're not the only people having a referendum, of course. There is to be a referendum, it seems, in the UK. So your question is, what is the referendum in the UK going to be about? And if it passes, what does the British government have to do about it?
Oh, no clip.
No.
Oh, the referendum. Well, it's about whether we should stay in the European Union or not.
It is. And if it's passed, what does that mean?
Well, if we leave the European Union, we won't have to have curly bananas anymore. Things like that, we can have
less regulation. Although, interestingly enough, the constitutional quirk of an unwritten constitution, if there's a referendum which is passed by the people of the UK, the government's not actually bound in any way to implement that decision. So it's kind of indicative. Only. That legal quirk brought to you by Question Time. And that is the end of the RN Drive quiz. Thanks one and all to our participants this evening, Nick Bryant from the BBC, Rebecca Huntley from Ipsos Australia, and Chris Berg from the Institute of Public Affairs. Thank you very much. And I don't know whether we've got it there, but I feel like we should just end with just one last reprise of that inspiring 1967 anthem, Vote Yes for Aborigines.
Vote yes for Aborigines, they want to be Australians too. Vote yes and give them rights and freedoms just like me and you.